That's the first question on the test. Spell it.
Okay.
SOC period.
This is going to be lecture number one. And watch the cord, too, just in case it's a loose thing there. Lecture number one in soteriology. Now, let me give you a few terms. Soteriology comes from the word soteria, for salvation, and logos, for word. So it means the word or study of salvation. Okay? But before we get to soteriology, we're going to have to discuss anthropology, coming from the word anthropos, for man, the doctrine of man, and then hamartiology, the doctrine of sin, and then from there, we'll go into soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. Okay? So, anthropology, the doctrine of man, God created man perfect, and then man fell because of sin, the doctrine of sin, hamartiology, and so therefore he needs to be saved, the doctrine of salvation. Now, also another doctrine, since Jesus is the Savior, in Christology we talked about the person and the work of Christ, we need to talk about that aspect of Christology, which is the doctrine of Christ, which deals with the work of Christ. Because the work of Christ was what he did in order to save us. So, because of that, in our textbook, Miller J. Erickson, his Christian Theology, we need to read chapter 16, which deals with God's plan. It's the required reading for this course. Chapter 16, which deals with God's plan. And then part 5, which deals with humanity, so that's anthropology, so part 5. Also part 6, which deals with sin, so that's martyrology, part 6. Then part 8, which is the work of Christ. And then part 10, which is the doctrine of salvation. So Miller J. Erickson's book you need to read. Chapter 16, and then all the chapters in part 5, all the chapters in part 6, and part 8, and part 10. And it's probably about a third of the book. So it shouldn't be too much. And have any of you guys read yet the Doctrine of Man? Got to that section? You're going to see that, unlike with Geisler's Introduction to Philosophy, I'm not teaching the textbook style. There's some points of disagreement that I have with Erickson, and I won't be referring to the text as much as I do with Geisler's textbook there. And so it'll be more separate. It'll be something where your reading is meant to highlight or add to what you already should be learning in the lectures. So soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. First we're going to look at anthropology, the doctrine of man. Now with the doctrine of man, we want to look at the origin of man, the original nature of man, which really entails it's the nature of man originally, his original nature, and then the nature of man after the fall, and then how did man receive his immaterial part, his soul or spirit. We'll look at when does life start, and the unity of mankind, and then man's final state. So let me jot that little few portions of the first section up there, the origin of man. The three basic questions that anthropology deals with, whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian, it's irrelevant in this point. The three questions that would come up would be, who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? And that's all that really anthropology, the doctrine of man, tries to answer, those three questions. And so, in our attempt to answer who am I, the nature of man, we're going to need to look at where I came from, the origin of man first. So, where did I come from speaks about the origin of man. Who am I speaks about the nature of man, what man is by nature, and where am I going. It speaks of the destination of man. And so first, the first thing we're going to look at is the origin of man, because it'll go a long way to help explain for us who am I, who is man. So with the origin of man, we've got several different theories. And the first is atheistic evolution. Atheistic evolution. We'll also look at theistic evolution. Theistic evolution. And then we'll look at some different views of creation. There's many different views of creation, actually. But we'll look at progressive creationism. In fact, you could even put these in two different categories if you wanted to. You could use atheistic evolution, and then, technically speaking, theistic evolution could be classified either under creation or evolution, depending on which side you're emphasizing. So you could even group the theistic evolution with the creation side, but I'm going to keep it as separate. But under creation, there'd be different views such as progressive creationism. Gap theory. And then what we'll call fiat creationism, which basically is at least close to a literal interpretation of the Genesis account, though there's some varying points within. So let's take a look at these three views. By the way, Erickson says in his book, something I disagree with, he says that the most evidence is between theistic evolution and progressive creationism. He's been hanging around too many scientists with PhDs who are very biased, and I think it's between progressive creationism and fiat creationism, and I would favor fiat creationism, and we'll discuss that why when I get later to it. But I think there's certain, for Erickson's a dynamite guy. When I met him in San Francisco, real friendly guy. Well, I had a lot of theological questions to ask him, and instead we spent the whole time talking about New Jersey because he recognized my accent. And but he's a real nice guy. But there are some areas where I disagree with him, and I think that area. I don't think he's a theistic evolutionist, but I think he just says that or progressive creationism because he wants to sound like he's in agreement with most scientists. However, I think there's a real easy way to be in agreement with most scientists, and that's just be an atheist. Of course, now that's the big turn on that, especially in astronomy, because of the Big Bang. Many are coming to a knowledge of at least the Creator at this point. But let's take a look at the origin of man. And atheistic evolution teaches that there is no God and that man is just an animal. There is no God, so man is just an animal. He's the highest evolved animal up to this point, but he is just an animal. Now, right away, you can see there's a big difference in that view of man than there would be in the Christian view of man. Also, life spontaneously developed from non-life. It all came about by chance. We're going to take a look at some of the supposed evidence for evolution. This is not a course on creation science. It's not a course on apologetics, so we can't spend too much time. So I'm just going to spend just a few minutes on some of the supposed evidence for evolution and try to offer just a real quick either refutation or another possible or a possible response where the evidence could speak for creation just as easily, if not more, than evolution. Supposed evidence for evolution, comparative anatomy. Example of this, an example of this would be the arm of a man, the fin of a shark, and the wing of a bird. There's much in common between those body parts. And so evolutionists would argue that this proves common ancestry. However, it could just as easily, in fact, probably even you can make a better case for common design. If you saw three of Norman Rockwell paintings on the wall, even if you never knew Norman Rockwell or any of his work, you would probably assume they were all done because of the common design, that they were probably done by the same artist. You wouldn't conclude that at one time one painting looked just like the other, and that slowly it changed into the others. You would just assume that a common designer designed all three of them, and that's why they have similarities. And it's the same with the design of a man, a shark, and a bird. Vestigial organs, like the tonsils or appendix, organs that supposedly we have no use for, and they say, well, this proves evolution because we've evolved out of our use for these things. Two things could be responded to there. Number one, if we do have organs that no longer work and the animal kingdom does, that could be a result of the fall. The fact that God created everything perfect, but now creation is existing in a non-perfect state, an abnormal state. Things are going downhill very swiftly, so it could be a product of the fall, or there could be a use that's just unknown to man. Whenever a scientist or a doctor says there is no use for this body part or there's no use for that, he's automatically assuming that he knows everything there is to know about it, because just because he doesn't know the view, he's assuming that he would know any other alternative, any possibility that could exist there, when in actuality that's not the case. It may be that the tonsils... In fact, with tonsils, now they don't pull them as quick as they used to. I think they used to pull them all the time because they got infected. And then they started finding, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of people were getting even worse sore throats afterwards. And what they were starting to speculate was that maybe the tonsils were created for the purpose of getting infected so that all the toxins go there and not somewhere else. So you might even be removing a person's protection by... remove it. In other words, the worse the tonsils would be, the more reason to leave them in there. But I don't know if that is the case. I'm not a medical doctor, but those are the two possibilities there. Embryology was another supposed evidence for evolution, that a single cell evolves into a human being. Problem is, the single cell at the moment of conception is fully human at the moment of conception. The genetic code, the entire genetic blueprint of that human being is there from the moment of conception. You have 23 chromosomes in the egg and 23 chromosomes in the sperm. Once they join together, you have 46 chromosomes. You have a new human being with an entirely different genetic code from the mother. All that is needed is just time and nourishment. And the stages of life will just go on normally. Now, with a single-celled animal, you don't have any genetic information for teeth. You don't have any genetic information for eyes. And so a single-celled A human being in the single-celled stage at the moment of conception is much different than a single-celled animal. What scientists have to prove for this to be evidence for evolution is how a single-celled animal could somehow get new genes for teeth and for eyes, and that's things that they've never been able to prove any of that. That's all speculation. All the scientific evidence goes against that. Paleontology. A lot of circular reasoning is done here. They will often date the fossils by the strata in which it is found, in which those fossils are found. So, well, how do you know how old the fossil is? Well, it was found in this kind of strata, and we date the strata. Well, how do you know the strata is that old? Well, by the fossils that we found there. So it's purely circular reasoning. They also, it's assumed that the strata took millions of years to form. Yet they found trees. I think they're called, what, polystrate fossils?
Yeah.
They found trees that are grown in through three or four different layers of earth that are supposedly have taken millions of years to fall. Yeah. So you do not have trees that take that long to grow and exist for that long. So what that tells you is the same type of strata that you find, evolution is fine and say, well, that's evidence for an old earth. We can find that same kind of strata in places where it had to have fallen rapidly. You also have a well, forget the exact location, a well basically standing on its tail that's been fossilized through many different strata. And again,
you are an archaea.
And again, it's gonna rot, it's gonna decay, obviously, before a million years are up. So all this speculation, you know, they say, well, you could prove evolution through the fossil record. Come again, you know, that just doesn't that doesn't really speak to me too much.
There's a new piece of evidence in this also. We do the last month, the month before, this episode of Science News, which is a secular science publication. There's a lab, I can't remember where the lab is, but they've created a process by which they can make oil in the lab. Which means it doesn't take any millions of years for a fossil to turn into oil. They can do it in the lab in minutes or weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And even if they try to say, well, that was with intelligent intervention, the Christian would say, well, then why couldn't an intelligent God
have done that?
Yeah. In fact, the early scientists who based modern science on the assumption that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way so that through reason man could find out about the universe in which he lived, early modern scientists who were Christians basically held to the belief that science, I can't remember if it was Bacon who said it or if it was Newton, but said that basically science was basically thinking God's thoughts after him, finding out what God had done years ago and just going over those, finding out about our past and what God had done. Also with the fossil record, new species appear suddenly and fully developed. You don't have some animal with fins that are slowly turning into arms, and so that you can go right through the fossil record and say, yeah, they're right down here, it's a fin. You go up a few layers and now you can see that they're turning into arms, and then you go up a few layers and now you got a full-blown arm. The new species appear suddenly and fully developed. By the way, there's certain of our organs that do not function. Most of our organs do not function unless they're fully developed. The lungs of a bird function totally different than the lungs of any other animal. In fact, Darwin said this is the type of evidence that would disprove his theory, and it did disprove it. And besides, just ignore that fact. The fact that if for anything to evolve into a bird, while those lungs were evolving during that, whether it's 100,000 years of time or a million years of time, however much time or little time you give, during that time, that species would cease to exist because we wouldn't be able to breathe. We wouldn't have fully developed lungs. And then to go from birds and to evolve into anything else, the same problem would be there again. So birds are a definite problem too. But new species appear suddenly and fully developed, and there have been found, in other words, no transitional forms.
Now, is this under theistic evolution?
No, this is still under atheistic evolution, and we talked about the supposed evidence for evolution, the comparative anatomy, vestigial organs, embryology, and paleontology. And what we're doing is we're refuting each one of these points.
Theistic evolutionists would answer all those limitations. Well, God did it. God did it.
Yeah.
God kept them all alive.
Yeah, and then we'll respond to the theistic evolutionists a little later. Let's see, mutations. That's supposed evidence for evolution. Mutations, it's a garbling of the genetic code. Most of them are harmful. Some of them supposedly help the species, at least temporarily. But a mutation, all it does is it garbles the genetic code. Let's say in the genetic code, let's say we had 26 letters. Now, obviously, there's more than that. If you're just a single-celled animal, you have enough genetic information to fill an entire library with volumes of encyclopedias. So just even in a single cell, you have much more than the alphabet. But let's say all you had was the alphabet and the genetic code. A mutation would garble the letters, would mix up the order they were in, but it would not necessarily... You need another pen here?
All right. I'll let you borrow this one, but it's my regular pen.
You lose. Oh, you are honored.
You lose it. I'll send Al Davis after you. But a mutation just garbles the already existing genetic code. So, if this was the genetic code, A, B, C, okay, a mutation of that would be maybe BCA or ACB. Well, if you need a D, if a D is the genetic information that you need to get eyes, to develop eyes, if a mutation occurs and you just keep garbling A, B, and C, you're never going to get eyes out of that deal. Okay? So mutations do not prove evolution. They've never been able to say where a single-celled animal gets genes for teeth, which is what you're going to need. You're going to need to develop some kind of theory over millions and millions of years how somehow they're going to develop, through mutations, new genetic information to get teeth, and that's not what mutations do. They only garble the genetic code. Also, the age of the Earth is an argument for evolution. The universe is supposed to be 3.5 to 4 billion years old, and even that differs. There's all
the universe of the Earth. I thought the universe was 10 to 12 billion.
Yeah. The age of the Earth 3.5 to 4 billion. How old they say the universe is?
10 to 12.
10 to 12 billion. Okay. Number one, the first problem with that view is uniformitarianism. Let me write that down. Uniformitarianism, which just basically teaches that the processes that are occurring today have occurred at the same rate they're occurring today indefinitely into the past at the same exact rate. Okay? By assuming that, if we found two books on the table and they both had the same amount of dust, we would assume they've both been there just as long. But supposing we had two books on the desk, we had one book on the desk for a day, and I came in and put a brand new book on the desk next to it and then dusted off the first book, they would both have the same amount of dust the second day, and it looked like they were there one day when one book was there 2 days as long. Well, we don't know if God dusted off the earth, there's things like creation, a worldwide flood. He could have created the universe with what we call signs of age, but which he never intended to be signs of age. For instance, did the first tree have rings in it? The first trees that he created. And even if it didn't, we would look at it and say, well, that tree is got to be more than 2 minutes old. Well, God might have created a full-grown tree. It seems that he created Adam and Eve full-grown. You know, how old was Adam a day after he was created? Well, he might have looked like he was 30 years old, but he was only a day old. And so the whole universe, right from the start, might have had signs of age. But even that, even if we gave the evolutionist an old earth that still does not rule out Christianity. You've got guys like you, Ross, and many Christians who are scientists who still hold to the belief in an old earth. Now what I want to do real quick is a real quick three-point case for creation. Make a case for an intelligent cause, an intelligent designer of the universe. Just really 3 points. First, the origin of the universe. When you look at the creation model and the evolution model, we find that the creation model is far superior. The reason why I say this is the second law of thermodynamics. See, now the first law of thermodynamics says that the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. No new energy is being created. No energy is being destroyed. It remains constant. But it does change its forms. And when it changes forms, it becomes less and less usable to us. We can change the form of a log by burning it and getting heat out of it. But once we burnt it to ashes, it's no longer usable to us for us to do it. That's why we're starting to recycle things. We're trying to get as much out of these things as we can. But the fact remains, the amount of energy in the universe, the amount of usable energy is winding down. What this tells us is that the universe, if it's winding down, you know, someday it will eventually reach a point when all the energy in the universe is totally useless. That is, of course, unless there is a God who intervenes. So if the universe is left to itself, all the energy in the universe will become totally useless. Which means if you go back in time, all the energy in the universe, if you go back far enough in time, there was a time when all the energy in the universe was useful. So, in other words, the universe is winding down. If it's winding down, it had to be wound up. The universe is going to have an end if left to itself, therefore it had to have a beginning. And so if the universe had a beginning, something outside, whatever had a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, something outside the universe had to cause it to come into existence. So that's the case for creation as far as the origin of the universe. Also, the origin of first light. A single-celled animal, what scientists would call first life. I think God's definition of life and scientists' definition of life are different, by the way. I'll get to that a little later. The origin of first life, a single-celled animal has enough specified complexity, highly complex genetic information to fill an entire library with information. Now, you can have a infinite number of explosions of a print shop, and you're never going to get by chance, by a random explosion, a full Webster's dictionary. It just won't happen by chance. It takes intelligent design. But here we have an entire library's worth of information just in a single cell. And so the origin of first life needs an intelligent cause. Also, the origin of complex life. Let's go from a single cell all the way on up to a human brain. The human brain contains enough information to fill 20 million volumes of information. And so you can't even get from one library to 20 million volumes by chance and through natural laws, and therefore that takes intelligent intervention as well. Now, that's our reputation of atheistic evolution. So now let's look at theistic evolution. The theistic evolutionist says that God used evolution to create man. It tries to reconcile evolution and the Bible. You know, God started the evolutionary process. Erickson differentiates between deistic evolutionist and theistic evolutionist. The theistic evolutionist, he not only started the process, but he guides it along. The deistic evolutionist just started the evolutionary process and just leaves it alone. But here, most people will call both groups theistic evolutionists. So God used evolution to create man, and they try to reconcile evolution in the Bible. Now, what I'd like to say is that when we look, examine the evidence, which we've done very briefly when we dealt with atheistic evolution, we find that evolution, if it is true, if evolution is true, it needs God. So the theistic evolutionists would be right that if evolution is to be rescued, it does need God. However, God does not need evolution. You see, in other words, if I was an evolutionist, I would become a theistic evolutionist. But then once I became a theistic evolutionist, I'd wonder, why in the world does God need evolution? Evolution needs God to jump all these gaps, to go from non-life, to go from nothing to something, to go from non-life to life, to go from single-celled animals to multi-celled animals, to go from animals without backbones to animals with backbones, and finally to go from apes to men. Every one of those jumps violates known scientific laws, such as the law of biogenesis, such as the cell theory, such as the second law of thermodynamics. Every one of these things has a gap or a violation of a natural law, and it would take something above nature, something supernatural, a supernatural cause, to jump every one of those. So the theistic evolution is right in this point. Evolution, if it's true, needs God. However, once you accept the existence of God, God does not need evolution. If God chose to create the universe in 6 days, He could have done it. Now, if God did use evolution, He covered His tracks, and that's real important for refutation of theistic evolution. If God used evolution, He covered His tracks. When we examine the supposed evidence for evolution, we find that it is really non-existent. Everything that they say, this definitely points to this. Every one of those things can be persuasive a matter be explained by creation, or can an even more convincing matter be explained by creation. And then you end up with some things, such as the origin of the universe, the origin of first life, and the origin of complex life forms, where evolution really has no explanation there, but the God of the Bible would definitely explain how those occurred. So evolution needs God, but God doesn't need evolution. And if God used evolution, He covered His tracks. In other words, if theistic evolution is true, not only is it not written in the Bible, but it's not found in the evidence either. I mean, you know, that's like Dr. Norman Geisler said with the fossil record. You know, these guys line up different animals and they make it look like they evolved into one into the other. Norman Geisler said, I can do the same thing with cars. I can take different kinds of cars, Mustangs, Corvettes, Camaros, just line these things up and make a case, make it look like, yeah, that evolved into that, and that evolved into that, and that evolved into that, and that wasn't the case. There's definitely a problem there. Take a look at Genesis 2:7. Now remember, these guys are attempting, theistic evolutionist is attempting to reconcile the Bible with evolution. Now, number one, you don't need to reconcile the Bible with evolution because evolution is standing on weak ground. But number two, evolution directly contradicts the Bible. Look at Genesis 2:7. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. God formed man from what? From the dust of the ground. Not from an ape. Not from another animal. Now, some of the theistic evolutionists will say, well, you're reading too much into it. He formed him from the dust of the ground, but this process took millions of years. At first, was a single cell, then evolved into something else, then into something else, and then something else, and eventually into man. That's a little far-fetched for me, But just to put the icing on the cake, take a look at verses 21 and following of Genesis 2. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Eve didn't evolve from monkeys. The woman was taken from the man's side. So we do more than stretch the first two chapters of Genesis to make evolution and the Bible reconcile. We have to just straight out either ignore or contradict the Word of God to try to reconcile the Bible and evolution. Also in Genesis 1, the orders of God's creation, when you look at the evolutionists, they've got the order in all different, a totally different order. By the way, too, in that fossil record, where you have things, you know how they act like on the bottom layer, you're going to find the simplest life forms, and they get more complex as they go up? Well, that's the rule. Well, there's more exceptions to the rule than there is the rule. Those layers that supposedly took millions of years to form have been shuffled in totally different orders, so that more times than not, you will not find the right order. But the most common order is the one that the evolutionists give. But that does not mean that it's more than half. It's just like saying Bill Clinton got more votes than Bush or Perot in the 92 election, but that doesn't mean that he got most of the votes. Okay, and although he didn't get the majority of the votes, he got less than half, but more votes went to him than to anybody else. It's the same way with the order. The order the evolutionists give, as far as my understanding goes, that order, the evolutionary order, will be found more than any other order at the same time. It's not even there the majority of the time. Now, with the creation model, since those layers didn't take millions of years to form, a lot of them were formed during the flood, a one-year flood, and upheavals in the Earth's crust. But these tremendous upheavals in the Earth's crust from tidal waves and all after the flood, and from the mountains rising and valleys sinking, that would cause a reshuffling around of a lot of these layers. Whatever the case, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 38 and 39, reads as follows: "But God gives it a body just as he wished, and to each of the seeds of a body of its own. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one flesh of men, and another flesh of beasts, and another flesh of birds, and another of fish." What I'm getting at here is theistic evolution shouldn't try to reconcile the Bible and evolution. Number one, the supposed scientific evidence for evolution is on very weak ground. And number two, it's just evolution directly contradicts the Bible. So we need to pick one or the other, either atheism or creation, not try to take a little from both because they contradict each other. So theistic evolution is false. By the way, many great Christian leaders like C.S. Lewis have held to theistic evolution. Okay, progressive creationism, the third view. Now we're looking at the three of the more famous views of creation: progressive creationism, the gap theory, and fiat creationism. Progressive creationism teaches that God's special acts of creation were separated by long periods of development. Let me repeat that. God's special acts of creation were separated by long periods of natural development. Okay? In other words, God would create a certain species or a group of species, and then they would just evolve within their species for a certain amount of time, and then God would intervene. In other words, the days of creation actually become long, long ages. And God intervenes maybe once a year, maybe a few million years, a little. He creates something else. And after millions and millions of years, then he comes on the scene and creates man, or And so God's special acts of creation were separated by long periods of development. Most Christian thinkers hold to this view. Okay. Miller J. Erickson, I would believe, holds to it, since he says it's either this or theistic evolution that has the best arguments for. He probably would be in the progressive creationism camp. So this holds to an old earth, but it rejects evolution. Now, I have one problem with it. I think there is good scientific evidence for an old earth, but I also think there is good scientific evidence for young earth, which leads me to believe that they both may even cancel each other out. Although there are some arguments for a young earth which seem to leave out any possibility of an old earth, but whatever the case, even if they canceled each other out, the biblical evidence alone, I think I would favor a young earth, or even possibly, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1, and then maybe God just decided, you know, hey, I don't... time has no effect on me. I'm just going to let it ride for a few million years. And then God starts with the first day and the second day or whatever. I could see possibilities of that. But once you get animals starting to be created, then I have a problem. If you've got animals being created and then millions of years of gaps before man comes on the scene, and this is where it is. Genesis 1, verse 31. And God saw all that He had made. This is after He created man, after the 6 days of creation, Genesis 1:31. And God saw all that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. So what that tells us, after God created everything, after He created man, He said it was very good. Now, Hugh Ross tells us there is no theological problem with having God creating a universe where millions upon millions of fossils have already been formed because animals have died all over the place, and then He creates man about 20,000 years ago. Hugh Ross says there's no theological problem there. That's probably why he's a scientist. Even theologians who hold the progressive creationism, I think that's a problem. I think we're watering things down a lot. I don't think it was part of God's perfect will that He create beings who would just naturally die, even though there was no fall of mankind, no sin yet, and He's just going to let them die.
Not to get too far off, but how do you explain the creation of creatures that are designed killing machines like sharks? Mm-hmm. There's no way a shark can survive without eating another animal.
Well, you know, and I don't have all the answers in that particular area, but we do know that man was not to eat animals until after the flood.
Right.
I don't know if animals began to eat other animals before that. I don't know what the whole story was. I do know we used to eat plant life, but I think scientifically we can call plant life life. I do not believe that the Bible would call plant life life.
Right, but I was saying sharks and other carnivores don't appear to be equipped to handle plant vegetation.
Well, you know, again, I can't answer it.
We don't know.
Yeah, you also had a different kind of vegetation before the flood. If there was a worldwide flood, you'd have the vegetation would be much more wholesome, which is probably why God had man eat animals after the flood. The command came in Genesis 9 after the flood. So I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but one thing I do know, if all that we ate before the flood was plants, scientists call it plant life because their definition of life is much different than our effective
cellular process.
Yeah, and it's pretty much taking in energy from the outside whereas the biblical word for life, and both in the Hebrew and the Greek, is the same word for the soul.
Right.
And so it would appear that you'd have to have an animal-type existence, animal life, before the Bible would classify it as life. Yeah. Now, a lot of people would say, well, that's ludicrous because scientists are this. Hey, scientists are making their classifying their. And I'm not saying their definition is wrong. If you define life in this way, then that is life. But it doesn't necessarily mean the Bible has to use a scientific definition, a modern scientific definition of life. Now to get around this, some guys have held to a view called the gap theory. The gap theory, Schofield used to hold to this. It's like progressive creationism, it holds to an old earth, but it denies evolution. But what this does, the creation days are literal days, literal 24-hour days, but it puts a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Look at it, verse 1. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, after that verse, then Satan fell. God created the heavens and the earth. He created a pre-Adamic race of human beings. When in actuality, all human beings come from Adam. If you didn't come from Adam, you're not a human. But anyway, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He's got this pre-Adamic race of beings who Satan leads them all astray. Satan falls, leads them all astray, and the whole universe is ruined, and this whole pre-Adamic race is going to go to hell. And so verse 2, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And these guys show you all kinds of verses where darkness is often equated with evil, and formless and void, how it just doesn't seem right, and the Spirit of God was moving over the waters. It says, and then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, so the creation account is the recreation account. And so with the gap theory, you've got the dinosaurs and this warped, mutated creation, all ruined by Satan. And now we're actually, in Genesis chapter 1, is a recreation. Number one, I think that they just let the old earth type of thinking get to them and were too intimidated by it and began to interpret the Bible by what science supposedly had proven rather than just interpreting the Bible. In other words, the cavemen and all, that would be fossils of a pre-Adamic race of non-regenerate creatures. Satan corrupted the old creation in this pre-Adamic race. And so in verse 2, God creates the universe anew. Now, there's no grammatical justification in the Hebrew for this. See, they would have to... I forget what the word is. They change one word to another word, and there's no justification for it in the Hebrew. And it looks like that's the end of the lecture.